Well, turn with me again, please, to Genesis chapter 3, and we shall be looking this morning at verses 16 to 19 of this chapter. In our Sunday morning services, we are working through the first 11 chapters of this book of Genesis, and this then is where we have reached here in chapter 3. The first part of chapter 3, you remember, is all about the triumph of the serpent. God has just created the universe, and the very crowning detail, the very crowning feature of this creation isn't the sun and the moon, and it isn't the stars, and it isn't the animals. It is the man, Adam. It's upon Adam that God bestows his very own image. It is to Adam that God assigns the role of dominion over all things, and it is with Adam that God himself enjoys personal fellowship and communion. Without any doubt at all, Adam is, as I say, the crowning feature of the creation. And for the serpent then, who of course, as we've said in previous weeks, is really Satan, and who hates God with an implacable hatred, for the serpent, Adam is a prize target. There could be no more prize target for the serpent than Adam. Because if you see the serpent can get Adam, if he can pull Adam down, if he can ruin Adam, if he can turn Adam into a disobedient rebel, and if he can turn Adam into a guilty, hell-deserving wretch, then that is going to be a triumph indeed for the serpent. And more, of course, when you consider, as we have again explained in previous weeks, when you consider that Adam doesn't stand alone, does he? Adam officially represents the entire human race that is going to follow him. So that the entire human race is caught up in him. His spiritual condition will automatically become their spiritual condition. His standing before God will automatically become their standing before God. And when you factor that into the equation, then this would be an incalculable success for the serpent if he can possibly bring Adam crashing down. And that, of course, is exactly what he does. He pulls it off. Everything goes entirely according to his plan. He brings Adam crashing down, and with Adam, the entire human race. He leaves Adam and Adam's progeny a race of guilty, hell-deserving wretches. The first part of the chapter, as I say, is all about the serpent's triumph. But then this middle part of the chapter contains God's response to the serpent's triumph. And it begins on a truly astonishing note. It begins in verses 14 and 15 on a note of hope. Now, the hope is the last thing that you're expecting here, isn't it? If ever you weren't expecting any glimmer of light whatsoever, it's here, when this has just happened. And yet here, of all places, God begins on a note of hope. And the hope then takes this particular form. It takes the form of an announcement. And God announces here that the serpent's triumph, which has just taken place and which has seemed, as we've just said, so impressive, the serpent's triumph is only going to be of temporary duration. Because eventually this serpent is going to be defeated. Eventually this serpent is going to be destroyed. Eventually this serpent is going to have his very skull smashed to smithereens. God is announcing then, right away here, in the very aftermath of what has just happened, he's announcing that the serpent's defeat is going to be overturned. This dreadful disaster that has taken place in the Garden of Eden is going to be reversed. It's going to be remedied. There is going to be redemption. And of course, as we said last time, in his announcement here, in verses 14 and 15, for those of us who have eyes to see it, There is the very first glimpse, isn't there, of what was going to happen many centuries later. The very first glimpse of Jesus Christ and his wonderful achievements there at the cross of Calvary. So God begins then in his response here on a note of unqualified hope. But God's response goes beyond verse 15. It continues now into verses 16 to 19. And this is rather different. In contrast to the giddy heights of verses 14 and 15, here now suddenly the tone becomes very somber indeed. And here now it's as if God is saying that yes, there is ultimately hope for the human race. Yes, there is ultimately redemption. Jesus Christ is going to come and crush the serpent's head. There is, in the last analysis, hope for the human race. But that does not alter the fact that I am profoundly displeased with what has just happened. I am profoundly displeased with this human race, which has just brought such guilt upon itself, which has just disobeyed me so seriously and so blatantly. And there are therefore going to have to be consequences for what has just happened. And I am going to, as it were, open the floodgates. And I am going to unleash upon this world which I created in such perfection and in such wonderful, impeccable beauty, I am going to unleash upon it a tide of brokenness and sadness and frustration and suffering. I am going to turn this world into a very messed up world, into a very disfigured world, into a very dysfunctional world. There are going to be consequences for this disobedience which has just taken place. And so in verses 16 to 19, then what we have is effectively two little glimpses of what this is going to look like. Two little glimpses of what this fallen world is going to look like. Two little glimpses of what the world is going to be like as God punishes it. As God bestows upon it, imposes upon it rather, the consequences of what has just happened there in the Garden of Eden. And the two glimpses are then, on the one hand, the pain that is going to accompany childbirth. That's what's mentioned in verse 16, isn't it? In other words, the pain of labor that every mother is going to experience as the baby makes that passage from the womb into the outside world. There's going to be great, intense pain. And that's one little aspect then of the suffering that is now going to descend upon the world. And then the other glimpse we have is in verses 17 to 19. And it's this unhappy relationship that is now going to exist between man and his environment. So that now his environment is going to resist him. It's going to produce thorns and thistles. It's going to give him a lot of hard work. And indeed, worse than that, ultimately, it's even going to turn into his very grave. The dust will return to dust. And so do you see what I'm saying then? That after the bright light of verses 14 and 15, God saying, yes, the serpent has done something devastating here, but there's hope. I'm going to send a redeemer. After the bright light of those verses, now we are being reminded that despite that, yes, there is going to be redemption, but at the same time, there is going to be suffering and brokenness and sadness and frustration as a result of what has just taken place. And we need to ask the question this morning then, what do we make of this passage? What should we do with verses 16 to 19 of Genesis chapter 3? And all I want to do is simply point out four different types of person this morning to whom I think this passage is applicable. Four different types of person to whom this passage is applicable, and I want to draw out then the application to each. First type of person, the unrealistic Christian. The unrealistic Christian. Who am I talking about? I'm talking about the kind of Christian who gives the impression that there's never so much as a cloud in the sky. The kind of Christian who never sighs, who never groans, who never puts his head in his hands. The kind of Christian who always has the same smile on his or her face. The kind of Christian who goes around saying, isn't everything great? God has saved us. We're going to heaven. Things just could not be better. Everything is absolutely wonderful. Now, don't get me wrong. The Apostle Paul commands, doesn't he, in the book of Philippians, that we are to rejoice in the Lord always. We're always to rejoice. And if indeed there is a Christian who is deriving no joy from their relationship with God and from the wonder of the gospel, then there's something wrong there, isn't there? It is a sin, surely, to be joyless Christians. We must take Paul's injunction seriously. We must rejoice always in the Lord. But that, I think, is very different to saying that isn't everything wonderful and things couldn't be better. Because that is unrealistic, isn't it? That is unbiblical. It is to read Genesis 3 and stop at verse 15. And then shut the Bible and say, wow, wonderful. God is redeeming. God is sending Christ. God is working this wonderful saving plan. And to just not touch the rest of the chapter. But you see, we must go on from verse 15. And we must recognize that this world is a fallen world. And we must seriously engage with that. And we must recognize that there is suffering. And that there is brokenness. And that there is sadness. And that there is frustration. And yes, of course, we must be those who focus on the wonder of God's redemption and who focus on it to such an extent that it becomes indelibly engraving upon our beings and we dream about it at night and it bleeds out of us when we're pricked that God is redeeming through Jesus Christ. We must focus on that unstoppably. But at the same time, I'm saying that when we watch the 10 o'clock news and we see wars going on, and we see famines going on, and we see all kinds of different trials and problems across the world, we should groan. And when we go and visit someone in hospital, and we pass by people who are so emaciated and who are suffering so much agony, we should sigh. And when we walk past a cemetery, and we see line after line of gravestones, we should feel the horror of this reality called death, the reality that our dust goes back to the earth. I'm saying that we should be those who seriously engage with the fallenness of this world. Christians who are joyful, yes, we have this underlying and ineradicable joy coursing through our veins. But Christians who can relate to the book of Ecclesiastes. Christians who can sing the Psalms, recognizing that sometimes, yes, like David and the other psalmists, we do worship God, crying out to Him and with tear-stained faces. Christians who take seriously this disfigured, disjointed, disordered world in which we live and don't then have this permanent and false and superficial smile fixed to our faces. That's the first person to whom I think this passage is applicable, the unrealistic Christian who needs to be reminded that the Bible doesn't stop at Genesis 3:15. Second person, the complacent theist. The complacent theist. Who am I talking about here? I'm talking about someone who believes in a God, that's why they're a theist, but who believes in a God who is basically a kind of Father Christmas figure who sits in heaven and is all jolly and smiley and basically endorses everything and everyone and will eventually just welcome everyone, bar perhaps Hitler and one or two others, will welcome everyone into heaven. Because this passage, I think, challenges that person, doesn't it? Because this passage is saying to us, hang on a minute. What about when the woman who is having her baby is in great agony? And God says, I have done this. I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. What about when we see great natural disasters, earthquakes, famines, and tsunamis and all the rest of it? And God is saying here that I've done it. I cursed the ground because of you. Then are we not being reminded that God is in fact angry with this world? You see, it wasn't like this before, was it? It wasn't like this in Genesis 1 and 2. But the fact that it comes now, the fact that now pain enters into childbearing and the ground becomes cursed, the environment becomes spoiled, it's because God is angry because of sin, because of disobedience. And the position then that God is simply this smiley-faced Father Christmas figure who endorses everything is untenable. When God here is quite explicitly and quite unmistakably imposing adverse things, adversities, on the basis of sin and disobedience in his creation. And if you're in that position this morning, perhaps someone here is. Perhaps that's the idea that you have of God. The concept that you have of him is this just all-accepting, uncritical deity. Then you need to take this seriously. And you need to realize something else as well. That the anger of God and the punishment of God that we see here expressed in suffering and sadness and brokenness, that is only, if you like, a foretaste and a foreshadowing of much greater expression of his anger and punishment that awaits the day of judgment. This is just a premature little eruption, if you like, of the true anger and the true punishment of God for sin and disobedience. And therefore, you still have the opportunity, before that comes, to repent and to go to God and to recognize, God, you are a God of justice. You are a God who must punish sin. Before that day of judgment comes, will you receive me? And will you forgive me through the work of Jesus Christ? And so, this passage then is, I think, a very direct challenge to that whole idea of God, that he is just this Father Christmas figure, when here we see him imposing suffering upon the world because of disobedience. Third type of person, the convinced unbeliever. The convinced unbeliever. I'm talking here about the kind of person then who doesn't want anything to do with Christianity at all, who finds Christianity really very objectionable, and who would often use this kind of argument that the God of Christianity causes suffering. The God of Christianity sends all kinds of disasters and all kinds of horrible things to this world. Well, I don't want anything to do, therefore, with Christianity. I don't want anything to do with a God who sends horrible things that hurt people to this world. Well, I think that this passage challenges that person. Because again, you see, this passage is reminding us, isn't it, that God didn't originally create the world with suffering in it. If he had, then if God had created the world and he had thought, well, I want to put oceans there because I like the look of those oceans, and I want to put mountains there because they're beautiful, and I want to put the planets there because I like those, and I want to make people suffer as well because I like that. If God had done that, if God had kind of included suffering as part of his creation there in chapter 1, then perhaps we might have some reason to query the character of this God. But you see, that wasn't the case, was it? Suffering comes only now in Genesis chapter 3, and it comes as a result then, as we've already said, of human disobedience. And it's brought out very forcefully, isn't it, in verse 17, where God says to Adam, "Cursed is the ground because of you." And you see, that's turning on its head, isn't it? The whole argument then of so many, when they see a natural disaster, they say, "Look at what God is doing." And here God is saying, no, you should say, "Look at what you have done to the creation. Yes, I'm doing it, but because of you. It's on account of you, on account of the sin that you, as a race, have committed, that there is suffering in this world." And if, therefore, you are in this position this morning, if you are someone who objects to Christianity on the basis of suffering in this world, and you say, "What kind of a God is that?" I'm saying to you, you need to rethink it. You need to reevaluate that. And you need to say, "Hang on a minute, why is there suffering?" And God says, "Cursed is the ground because of you. It's because of the human race. It's because of our sin." And again, then, we need to go to God for forgiveness and for reconciliation. So this passage then, it's applicable to the unrealistic Christian, to the complacent theist, to the convinced unbeliever. But then fourthly, and finally, it's applicable, I think, to the pessimistic believer. To the pessimistic believer. Because I'm talking here then about the person who is a believer, a Christian, but who sometimes, seeing the messed upness of this world, sometimes watching the news on an evening, just feels, "Hang on a minute, this redemption promised by God in the Bible, it seems so remote. The world is in such a terrible state still. Is God really about any kind of redemptive program here? Is anything really happening? Or is it just a figment of my imagination? Is it just something that in actual fact isn't going to come to fruition at all?" Well, we said earlier on, didn't we, that we mustn't stop at verse 15 of Genesis 3. We must go on to verses 16 to 19. But at the same time, you see, we mustn't read just verses 16 to 19 without also reading verses 14 and 15. We must put verses 16 to 19 in that context. And we must remember that this very dark and bleak passage where we're being told of the brokenness of this world as a result of Adam's disobedience, that comes in the context of this redemptive promise that has just occurred in verse 15. And I think it's very interesting to see how Paul, the Apostle Paul, could not read Genesis 3, 16 to 19 without seeing it in the light of verses 14 and 15. Why do I say that? Well, you know how in Romans chapter 8, Paul refers to this passage, to what we've been looking at this morning. In Romans chapter 8, verse 20, he talks there about how the creation was subjected to frustration. What's he talking about? He's talking about what happens here in verses 16 to 19 of Genesis 3. He's talking about how God imposed suffering and brokenness upon the world as a result of Adam's sin. That was God subjecting it to frustration in Paul's terminology. But it's interesting, isn't it, what Paul goes on to say. He says, "The creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it," so that's God, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay. And when you read that, you immediately kind of go back to Genesis 3, verses 16 to 19, and you kind of think, well, where's the hope bit? What's Paul referring to? There's no indication in these four verses that there's going to be some future ending of this frustration and this brokenness and this bondage. But the point is, you see, that Paul is reading Genesis 3, 16 to 19 in the light of verses 14 and 15. And Paul hasn't forgotten, as he reads these dark verses, the bright light that precedes them. And he hasn't forgotten that the serpent is going to be crushed. And in the crushing and the defeat of the serpent, Paul understands that there lies the final answer to this brokenness and this sadness and this frustration that God is imposing upon the creation, that it is going to be liberated and it is going to be freed. And this sadness and brokenness is only going to be of temporary duration. One day the creation will be renewed. And one further thought here that encourages further hope and optimism for those of us who are believers as we read these dark verses. And it's those last words of verse 16 which have often caused people problems to know what exactly it means. Your desire will be for your husband and he will rule over you. It's often held that is a further part of the curse, a further part of the suffering that God is imposing. Not only is there going to be pain in childbirth, but perhaps it's saying that women are going to be oppressed and downtrodden by men. Their desire is going to be for their husbands, but their husbands are going to kind of rule over them with a rod of iron or something like that. But I don't think that is probably what is being said here. I think the point is this, that in the light of the first part of verse 16 and this idea of pain accompanying childbearing, serious pain, anguish, agony that is going to accompany childbearing, you might have thought, mightn't you, that the human race would have just finished. Because what woman is going to want to go through with this? What woman is going to want to have children when it's going to be accompanied by such terrible agony and such terrible pain and such terrible anguish? You'd have thought that every woman would have said, well, forget that. Forget men, forget sexual relations with men, forget the whole business of childbirth if it's going to be accompanied by such terrible agony. But you see, God has just promised, hasn't he, in verse 15, that there's going to be a line coming from Eve, a biological line. There's going to be a seed of the woman. And that, therefore, requires, it demands, that there are going to be children born. And there's going to be generation after generation after generation. And so it seems, then, that the first part of verse 16 jeopardizes verse 15, doesn't it? God is promising a seed, a line of descendants of Eve, and yet here we're being told in verse 16 that childbearing is going to be accompanied by great pain, and so surely women aren't going to bother with it, and so there's not going to be any seed after all. And that's why I think God adds in the second half of verse 16, by way of grace, by way of comfort here, by way of reassurance, your desire will be for your husband. In other words, he's saying, but look, you women, even despite the pain that's going to accompany childbirth, you will still want to have sexual relations with men. You will still want to bear children. And still, your husbands will rule over you, not in a bad sense, but in the biblical sense. In other words, this is a shorthand for marriage. Your husband will rule over you. There will still be marriage. There will still be marriage. There will still be childbearing. Even though it's going to be accompanied by so much pain, it will still continue. I will ensure those instincts remain. And this does continue. And therefore the seed of the woman can go on. And therefore the Messiah can come. And therefore my promises can be fulfilled. And so I'm saying then that even here in these dark verses, verses 16 to 19, there's hope here. Because of the bright light of verse 15, it still shines into the darkness of verses 16 to 19. And we can, therefore, as Christians, watch the news, read the newspapers, look at the world around us, groaning, yes, sighing, yes, despairing, yes, crying out to God for mercy, yes. But hopeful, yes, certain, yes, that God is about the business of redemption. One day, Jesus Christ, the one who on that cross wore a crown of thorns, symbolizing the curse of the ground falling upon him, Jesus Christ will return at the end of history. And he will renew the creation, and all its sadness and all its brokenness will be gone forever. And the creation will dance, and the creation will sing, it will be rejuvenated. And we who are his will enjoy it forever with him. We may have hope in the midst of a desperately sorrowful world. Thanks be to God. Amen.